Thank you very much, Rob, for the introduction. Thank you to Credit Suisse for the opportunity to return to this conference and to come back to Hong Kong. When I was here 2 years ago, the United States had just avoided the feared double dip recession. Europe was in the news with acute concerns over the feedback between weak economies, poor asset quality in banks, and sovereign finances. China's growth had moderated. Many feared at that time that it would decline sharply. Since then, the world economy has continued its expansion. Growth in global GDP was a little below average last year, with some reasonable prospects of a pickup this year. None of the downside risks, none of the big ones anyway, that exercised minds a couple of years ago have as yet come to pass. That doesn't mean that they can't or won't, but it is worth observing that the world economy has been climbing the wall of worry, not entirely without success over the past couple of years. So what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about the global outlook as we see it, and try to give a sense of how that's relevant to Australia, and then talk about the Australian economy itself. Overall, this year, most forecasters think global growth will be a little higher than last year and probably at about its long-run average pace. More of the growth is coming from the advanced world and proportionately a little less than in recent years from the emerging world, and I think actually that rebalancing is welcome given how weak a number of the advanced countries have been over the past few years. The US continues its recovery led by private spending, and over the second half of last year expanded at an annualised pace of around 3%. Recent developments in the US fiscal debate mean that that particular headwind from last year will abate somewhat this year. There has been, of course, the effects of the severe weather of late, so it will be a little while yet before the US policymakers can get a clear reading of the pace of expansion. But there's no obvious reason, I don't think, to expect that the US expansion will be derailed. The euro area has resumed growth, somewhat hesitant and with considerable differences in strength across countries. There are some quite profound adjustments going on, actually, in relative cost structures in the so-called peripheral countries, as there have to be under the single currency arrangements. In Japan, the initial results of the measures of the past 18 months is quite positive, though, of course, the proposed so-called third arrow reforms are yet to be delivered. The much-anticipated tapering, so-called, of the Fed's monthly asset purchases commenced in December. The initial expectation of this in the middle of last year caused more market ructions than the event itself when it finally came along. That said, as often occurs when the Fed changes course, investors have taken the opportunity to reassess their positions and their appetite for risk. I think it's important to note that, at least in my view, so far, investors have not run from risk indiscriminately. They've drawn distinctions between alternative classes of investment and between countries that have differing outlooks. Long-term sovereign yields, for example, for the core advanced countries remain very low, and with compressed risk spreads, that means that borrowing costs for many private borrowers remain very low. It's true that a few emerging market countries have been under pressure, with bond yields spiking and exchange rates going down. In most of those instances, I think you can identify legitimate domestic sources of worry for investors. It's notable, though, that the number of emerging countries that are under acute pressure right now is smaller than it was in the middle of last year, and that's at least partly because some countries have undertaken confidence-enhancing adjustments to policy in the intervening period. So far, so good, in my opinion, for tapering. And I think we should welcome tapering. There is a tendency, though, to talk about so-called normalisation of monetary policy in the advanced countries as if it's happening in all of them. It isn't. It's really only happening in the US. Even there, it's at a very early stage, but the US is at least on a path towards normalisation, whereas the euro area and Japan are not even thinking about that path. In fact, in those jurisdictions, as far as I can tell, the discussion is really about whether further easing may be needed. Were the Bank of Japan to step up its asset purchases, it would very soon be adding more cash to the global financial system than the Fed is. Intriguingly, though, the BOJ's actions get much, much less attention than those of the Fed. Now, I'm not in a position to opine about whether or not further such easing either in Japan or Europe might occur or might be appropriate, but the point simply is that the monetary policy trajectories of the major currency areas could diverge and could increasingly diverge over the next couple of years. An interesting question is how fully priced that possibility is in exchange rates and other markets. Turning then to the Asian region, China's economy grew close to, in fact a little faster than, the government's stated target last year. Strong and about equal contributions to growth were made by household consumption and investment. CPI inflation continues to be stable. There are some recent indicators that appear to show possible signs of slower growth in China early this year. IP, retail sales, vehicle sales and so on have moderated. Given that the growth target was more than achieved last year and given the difficulties with the Chinese New Year in assessing the trends in the data, it's probably a little too early to draw strong conclusions here. Things that are important to Australia, like spot prices for steel and iron ore, have fallen lately, though so far that's still kept levels within the range seen in recent years. So a little early to tell whether this possible slowdown is a large one and how persistent it might be. In fact, in my opinion, people are probably too inclined to fret about what are still rather small movements in monthly PMIs in China and that sort of thing. Sometimes they seem to fret even more than people fret about small movements in American data. I think the greater concern really is not those things, it's the risks involved with the build-up of credit in the so-called shadow banking sector in China over recent years. To a considerable extent, the growth in that sort of financing activity surely reflects the natural tendency for market participants to seek to avoid the effects of price and quantity constraints imposed on the core banking sector in an environment in which the demand for credit has been very strong. In certain respects, it's arguably the case that those so-called shadow banking activities provide genuine services to the real economy, which are welcome. The potential problems, on the other hand, are well known, and you know them all. They include excessive maturity mismatches, where long-term loans are funded essentially by short-term borrowing, less than ideal transparency about asset quality, distorted incentives for provincial government entities, assumptions on the part of investors in wealth management products about the extent of major bank or government support, and so on. Recent credit events in China have resulted in more focus on the possibility of failure of entities that have non-viable business models. There has been some widening in risk spreads for lower quality credits, and really, actually, risk spreads in China were never all that compressed anyway. So to some extent, all of this might be seen as a favourable development. A clear-eyed assessment of risk and pricing of underlying economic risks is critical for sound long-run development in China, no less than in any other country. But of course, we can't know at this point how much further this reassessment of risk may have to run, nor how disruptive it could turn out to be for the Chinese financial system and the Chinese economy. I think it is clear that the Chinese authorities are across these issues, and in all likelihood they have the ability and the resources and probably the time to deal with them. A number of reforms are already in train that will help to mitigate such risks in the future, and their attempts to slow down the overall pace of total financing in the economy seem to have borne some fruit. There are a number of other broader reforms going on in China in the direction of financial market liberalisation. These include the removal of restrictions on most lending rates, with those on deposits expected to follow, widening of the trading ban for the RMB, commitments to let markets play a greater role in setting prices and allocating resources, and so on. So those things are all welcome, and I think they're very much in China's long-run interests. Around Asia generally, at this stage, our sense is that growth is continuing at about its average pace. We'll all be watching what happens in China and the impacts on capital flows and risk pricing as the Fed continues their tapering and as other major central banks implement their policy decisions. Let me turn then to the Australian economy. And here I continue to find a fascinating divergence between the views of foreign observers, especially in Asia, many of whom say to me, Australia is doing very well, on the one hand, and then the tone of commentary at home, on the other, which has typically been considerably more pessimistic in recent years. My reading of the actual data for what is that they suggest something in between. They say the economy is doing a bit better than much of the domestic commentary would have you believe, but perhaps not quite as well as some of the foreign investors may have thought. We certainly weathered the financial crisis well, and with a real GDP today some 13% bigger than it was 5 years ago, that compares very well with many of the advanced countries. It is the case, though, that growth, while positive consistently, it has been running at a pace below trend for about 18 months now. The rate of unemployment has risen by about a percentage point over that time. Now, most people are familiar with the fact that there have been very strong conditions in the natural resources sector, the mining sector. The biggest positive terms of trade shock in at least a century drove a mining investment boom of truly epic proportions, and that added a major impetus to demand in Australia's economy. But the terms of trade peaked 2.5 years ago now. The capital spending by the resources sector has also peaked. It's expected to decline quite significantly over the next couple of years. Turning to the rest of the economy, well, households have spent much of the past 5 years behaving more conservatively, or I should say more normally, than they had over a long period up to about 2008. Both consumption and residential construction have been soft for quite some time, and I've spoken at length about these trends in other places in the past and explained why they were to be expected. Nonetheless, many business models that were exposed to the household sector have found the going considerably more difficult in the past 5 years than they had been up till then. In addition, because the mining boom was associated with a very high exchange rate, other trade-exposed sectors have also faced quite challenging conditions in recent years. Looking ahead, then, as the resource sector's capital spending continues to fall, it will be desirable for some other sector sources of growth to strengthen. One of those is export volumes for the resources themselves, and they are growing very strongly now that the capacity has been put in place. Just as one example, iron ore shipments are up by 85% from 5 years ago, running at about 1.5 million tonnes a day now, and they will rise further to 2 million or so over the next couple of years as additional capacity comes on stream. We'll probably also get a little bit better export performance from some other sectors that will be just a little bit less squeezed by the exchange rate in the next year or two than they have been previously. It's unlikely, though, that a pickup in resource exports, as important as that's going to be, will be enough to keep overall growth on the right track. So it will be helpful for some areas of domestic spending that have hitherto been subdued to grow faster. For that to occur, households would need to have made progress on their desire to lift saving and to consolidate their debt where needed. Businesses outside of mining would need to have made progress in containing costs, lifting their efficiency. And they'd also need to have a bit more confidence about the future than they did before, as a precondition to making plans to lift their capital spending and to raise their workforces. Well, happily, there are some promising signs in this regard. Recent data shows stronger household consumption over the summer, and the latest surveys and our own liaison confirm that. And they suggest that retailers, while hardly ebullient, I think at this point are considerably more positive than they were a year ago about the outlook. That having been said, we expect consumption to grow in line with income or maybe a little faster, but not at the pace that we saw in the period preceding the financial crisis. We certainly see abundant signs of confidence in the housing market. Here, dwelling prices are up 10% roughly over the past year on a nationwide basis, and they're 5% higher than the preceding peak in 2010. Initially, that wasn't associated with much in the way of a pickup in credit growth, but there is some increase in credit to households now, albeit the rate of growth is much slower, and I think likely to remain so, than it used to be for the 1990s and the 2000s. The pickup in credit is most notable for investors, and here I would again say that investors need to take care with the amount of leverage that they take on. It's clear that dwelling construction activity is going to rise strongly over the next year or two. For the past 3 months, approvals to build dwellings have been at the highest rate in 30 years. That increase is welcome, certainly at the aggregate level, because Australia has not really been adding enough to our dwelling stock in recent years, given the pace of population growth. Measures of business confidence have improved over the past 6 months. Businesses do seem, however, so far, to be taking a cautious approach to investment plans. They're waiting for stronger and more persistent signals of improved demand before they commit to significant increases in capital spending, and that's actually pretty normal at this point of the cycle. They're also showing somewhat more promising signs in their hiring decisions, I would say, or their hiring intentions, but it's too soon yet to see much in the way of concrete evidence of higher employment. So there are encouraging early signs of the so-called handover from mining-led demand to broader private demand, that's starting to happen. Putting all that together, we think that economic growth will continue. It may strengthen a little later this year and pick up further in 2015. It's important to stress, of course, in talking about the outlook, that this forecast is quite obviously a balance between some very large negative forces, namely the decline in mining capital expenditure that's coming on the one hand, and the likely pickup in some other sources of demand on the other. That's all helped by lower interest rates, improved confidence and so on, and to some extent also by the decline in the exchange rate we've had over the past year. But because we're trying to assess the balance between these very different forces, there is inevitably a very substantial margin of uncertainty surrounding our central forecast, and indeed any central forecast that you could make at this point. That's simply unavoidable in the circumstances that we face. The fact is, no one can say with any certainty at all just how smooth a handover from mining to non-mining will occur, nor can anybody, including me, pretend to be able to fine-tune that. On inflation, well, we think inflation will be a little higher than we thought a few months ago, and that takes account of the most recent data, which was a bit higher than expected. Nonetheless, we don't think at this stage that signifies a persistent and serious problem with inflation. if you step back and think about the overall scenario we have, we've had rising unemployment, probably will rise a bit more yet. Wages growth has slowed down, and indeed measures of unit labour costs, if they're growing at all, growing very, very slowly. So unless we have continual increases in profit margins for businesses, we don't seem to have the conditions in place for a significant problem with higher inflation. Measures of expectations of inflation remain well anchored, and so our view is that while inflation will probably a little higher than we thought before, is still going to be consistent with our medium-term target. Trends in asset prices will be, for us, an area to watch. We need to be alert to the possibility that the past year of strong rises in dwelling prices leads people to assume that that's the norm. If that happened, if such an assumption came to be held, and if that was accompanied by more speculative activity and a renewed increase in household leverage with all the associated risks that that brings, that would be unwelcome. This is a theme we've discussed in some detail in our financial stability review, which has just come out today. We're watching this area closely, and we take opportunity once again to remind people that housing prices don't just go up, they can go down. They have gone down a couple of times in the past decade. The Australian Prudential Regulation Authority will also be emphasising with lenders and with their boards, as they've been doing for some time now, the need to maintain high standards for lending. There's, of course, the full panoply of other risks to the outlook that we can identify. The exchange rate's a source of uncertainty, as usual. Much of what happens in Australia will depend on developments overseas, and so in places like Europe, we, along with all of you, I'm sure, are looking for further progress towards the full treatment of the banking problems and the return to fiscal sustainability. With greater certainty in the US over their fiscal outlook now and over the path of monetary policy, it may even be that the risks to the US are more to the upside than the down. On the other hand, there could be some event, some sort of geopolitical shock, you can all think of what they could be, that could lead to a wider retreat from risk-taking, and if that occurred, then that could have a significant dampening effect on the global economy. China's outlook, obviously, for Australia is important. Actually, it's important for everybody now. There will be very few, if any, significant economies for whom China is not the number one or number two trading partner these days. So it's important for us all. Not only the way that they manage the current financial issues, but the way they approach the implementation of the sorts of structural reforms they're talking about over time, all of these things will be important for all of us. Turning then to monetary policy in Australia, well, as Rob said, we've been masterfully sitting still since last August at what by any standard for us is a very accommodative setting for policy. And that's playing its part in supporting sustainable growth in demand consistent with the inflation target. We've signalled that if the economy evolves in line with our present set of forecasts, a period of stability in interest rates could be expected. Having said that, let me then turn back to the global perspective just for a moment before I finish. And that is to make the point that sustainable growth in any country over the long run has to rely on more than just monetary policy. Strong long-run growth won't be achieved in any country just by manipulating interest rates, or for that matter, by manipulating exchange rates. Monetary policy's main contributions over the long run is to provide a stable monetary standard. That's a necessary condition for growth, but not a sufficient one. Nor will fiscal expansion serve as more than a temporary boost to growth. Indeed, the limits to fiscal activism in most countries, certainly many countries in the advanced world, surely are now very apparent. It's other conditions, really, that are more important for growth in the medium term, and they need to be right. They include ensuring that the environment for competition, for innovation, for investment, including in human capital, are sound. It's in those areas and others, perhaps, that various government policies must come to the fore to secure longer-run growth. And it's in that spirit that the countries of the G20 recently committed in Sydney at their meeting to coming up with measures that could raise the level of world GDP by 2% above what it would otherwise have been over a horizon of 5 years. That's not to be achieved by a program of cheap money or by debt-financed public spending. Many of the measures needed are likely to be politically demanding for governments. But if signing up to that challenge, and I think people were very conscious at that meeting of what they were signing up to, if signing up to that helps to galvanise efforts for the sorts of reforms that need to be made, then it will have been worthwhile. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'll make an attempt at your questions. Thanks.
So we've got about 20 minutes for questions. A microphone will come around, and you can use that to ask questions. Perhaps we might start in the front here. Yeah.
Mr. Stevens, given that the monetary policy of Australia was relatively successful compared to other parts of the world, and you are not so inflicted with other monetary areas in the world, do you have an idea how this fiat money in Europe and the US will ever leave the market again?
Will ever leave?
The market again?
I think there are two lenses through which you might contemplate that question, and I think we have a session this afternoon on some of this. There's the technical lens. You know, how do you go about extracting the cash that's in the system when the time comes? And I don't really think that's a technical difficulty. I think the Fed, being the most advanced, will have thought about that, and I'd be pretty confident they can accomplish that in a operational sense. The other lens is the broader sort of political economy overall setting, and I think that will be a difficult challenge for all the central banks that have done so-called unorthodox policies. I mean, it's always hard to tighten policy, I can tell you, even conventional policy, when the time comes to tighten. There's all sorts of people with arguments as to why you shouldn't do it. We know that. That's part of the process, and we're accustomed to dealing with it. That will be the case with withdrawing the cash as well, and that is why it's imperative, I think, that the independence of central banks be preserved and that we retain clarity about what the longer-run goals are. If we do that, then I think there's a reasonable hope that this can be accomplished reasonably successfully. But there are, you know, conditions we need to remain in place for that to be so.
It's been some time since you've mentioned the FX rate, and I'm wondering if the RBA still feels that the Aussie is overvalued and whether 90 is still the unofficial level in the sand, if you will.
I'd be very reluctant to draw lines in sand in the exchange market, but what we've said, it's worth giving some context here. When the currency went very high, when the terms of trade were soaring to easily the biggest episode in probably since the 1850s, we didn't feel that it was appropriate to try to limit that given the size of the event. When the terms of trade started to fall and the exchange rate seemed initially unresponsive to that, we thought that was odd, probably unhelpful if it persisted, and we said that. Happily enough, the currency is now well down off its peak. I would say that from here, it really depends on what you think the fundamentals will do. The assumption that we make about the terms of trade, and it's very transparent in our published material, is that they will fall further. We're probably not as pessimistic as some observers, but nonetheless, we think that commodity prices will be softer on average in the future than they've been in the recent past. Our terms of trade will be lower. It would be quite surprising in that world, if that comes to pass, if the Australian dollar didn't depreciate somewhat along with that. So if you buy our set of assumptions about the future terms of trade, I think that draws you to the conclusion that the long-run equilibrium of the exchange rate is probably lower than what we presently observe, and we've been quite consistent in saying that.
With regards to the handover from the mining sector to the non-mining sector, is my impression right that the non-mining sector, in order for overall growth to remain the same, the non-mining sector would not just keep its current growth rate, but actually the growth rate would have to accelerate with regards to that?
That's right.
And how do you see the risks? Do you think it's a symmetric risks, or is it just the risk that the non-mining sector won't grow enough to make up?
Well, the premise of your question is correct. The rate of growth of the non-mining sector, and you have to do a bit of number work and make the odd heroic assumption to even put a figure on what the non-mining sector is and what its growth is, but you know, we've done that. And its growth has been very much sub-trend for several years. So if this works out nicely, that growth is going to pick up to maybe be a little bit above its trend pace over the next year or two as mining comes down, and the total will be adequate. The balance of risks, it's hard to say. I think probably up until this point we would have said that waiting for business investment to turn up, you always wait a long time for that. And my memory of previous cycles is we always waited longer than we kind of felt we really should have to wait, but that's the way it is. I think it's pretty clear that some elements of this, like the residential construction side, and that's only a modest part of it, but it's pretty clear that's going to turn up very strongly. You know, we're going to have a boom in residential construction over the next couple of years. So that's, I would say, very much on track. Consumers, I'd say, largely on track. The non-mining business investment part, it's just too soon to know yet. I think there are promising signs, but that's all you can say at this point, because that's inevitably the way it is. So there remains, I guess, some risk that doesn't pick up on cue. Separate question, what one can really do about that if that turns out to be the case, to be honest with you, because it's not amenable to fine-tuning.
If you look at the components of Australia's CPI over the past decade or so, services inflation has run at around 4% and goods inflation has been close to zero. If you take the assumption that China will export more inflation and deflation versus history and the Australian dollar will weaken at the margin, would you expect that to become a problem in terms of the overall inflation level?
I think, let's frame that with the current forecast, which is on, I think it's on about 89 or 90. For the exchange rate by technical assumption. That's all that is, a technical assumption, not a forecast itself. I think we're okay relative to the inflation target there. I think if the exchange rate comes down, but that's in the context of terms of trade declining and the contractionary things that brings, then you've got, I guess there's some low level at which it could give us a problem, but I don't think that we're in danger of seeing a serious outbreak of inflation over that sort of scenario. And bear in mind that for the non-traded part, the part you're referring to, which is mainly services, the degree to which labour costs have slowed quite markedly. You know, the wage price index is recording about its lowest rate of increase at the moment in the history of that survey, which is about 15 years. I think you'd have to feel that While ever that's the case, we can probably absorb the temporary hits from the exchange rate going down without too much trouble. That's my sense at the moment.
Mr. Governor, here. Just a question. How much consideration do you put into the asset price when you're conducting monetary policy? Take Greenspan's time. Obviously, we know that the probably not enough attention to the U.S. asset price, particularly housing price. I mean, coming back to the Asia, we already see that the China's property prices start to crack. Hong Kong property price already coming down. And probably Australia is the only major Western country haven't seen significant adjustment in the property sector. So how much risk do you consider this is going to be? Thank you.
Well, there are two questions there. One of them is the extent to which we pay attention to asset values. And the answer to that is I think we've always been in the camp for a long time now where we felt asset prices, and particularly it's not the asset prices per se or not those alone that's the thing, it's the leverage. So unleveraged asset booms and busts I think are much less damaging. You know, if you want to have an asset bubble in rare stamps or works of art, I'm not that worried, frankly. Because the banking system isn't providing the leverage. Houses or commercial property really historically in many countries has been probably the number one source of problems for when banks get into trouble. You know, very high proportion of the time you'll find it's commercial property that's the culprit. And as you say, in some countries in the past decade, housing values have come to the fore as well because household leverage is much higher. So we've always felt that was important. We've not gone to the point of feeling that you should make a particular level of asset values a formal objective for policy. I don't think you should do that, but I think you ignore asset and credit market dynamics at your peril. So we pay a lot of attention to it. The second part of the question is what's the extent of the risks? And the position that I've had over time is, let me give a few bits to this. There are people who think that Australia's got a bubble. You can never be 100% sure that you haven't. You never say never. My observation simply is that the price-to-income ratio for the household sector as a whole, it's been around 4 for 10 years, up and down a bit around that mean. That's higher than it used to be, but it's been there for about 10 years. So very long-running bubble, if it is indeed a bubble. Most bubbles don't last that long. Second thing I'd say is that, and we're on record as saying that some increase in housing prices in a cyclical sense that we've had in the past year, it's a bit soon to get on the soapbox about that because that's part of the normal cyclical dynamic. That's the second point. But the third point is, I think it'd be unwelcome if we keep getting 10% a year, or more particularly if people think that 10% a year is now the norm and there's no risk of a decline. As I said earlier, we've had housing values go down twice for a year or so at a time. Twice that's happened in the last 10 years. It does happen, and people shouldn't assume that it can't. And provided they keep an appropriate sense of the risk and we keep the leverage contained, then we'll probably be okay. There's one down here.
Another question on the thorny issue of the handover. So, and this is a little following up on what was asked earlier. It seems like your assessment of aggregate growth, with taking into account the resource-dependent sector as well as the domestic sector that is rebounding from sub-trend growth, solves for a fairly high number on aggregate. For example, if we compare to the U.S., or at least what the Fed thinks trend growth is, it seems like you're expecting Australia to do better and even to accelerate over the next couple of years. So my question is, For one, why would Australian trend growth be that radically different from the US in general over a long time? Because generally speaking, these economies in many ways are very similar, except the fact that Australia is now dealing with the aftermath of the resource boom, especially given your assumption about deteriorating terms of trade. Obviously, historically, big deviations from trend growth to the downside during these periods. So it seems like, so two questions. Is Australia's trend growth, why is your perception of it so high, or it seems to me that it is high? And secondly, isn't it natural to be below trend for some time?
It is natural to be below trend some of the time, we have been for the past 18 months.
That's a very short period of time, though, right?
It's long enough to make a difference to things. And, you know, the clearest metric of that's the rate of unemployment's been going up in that time. And it's almost certainly, I would say, I don't know where the Nehru is, but we're higher than it at present. What's the trend pace of growth? I'd still say that at the moment, potential growth is probably about 3. The number before the decimal point, I'd say, is 3. The number after isn't a very big number, so it's 3, a little bit over 3. I'm not sure what the Fed says about the US, probably 2 point something. Yeah, well, I don't think our potential growth is as low as 2.25. If I take historical productivity performance, which I think we're getting back to now, having been a bit poorer than that, and I take population growth of 1.5-ish for working age population, we've actually got pretty fast population growth for an advanced country. So you're going to get to 3 at the moment pretty easily. In time, thinking out over the, you know, a 5 to 10 year horizon, there are reasons to think potential growth comes down to do with demographics. And we will get that effect, and we'll have to recalibrate what we think of potential as that. And that this is starting, but it hasn't got very far yet. But right now, I think the economy's got ample potential to grow at 3. So, and we've been below that, and we're still below that. The short-term forecasts are we stay a little bit below it for a little while yet before we get above.
Hi. This is just a follow-on question with regards to inflation as well as with the handover from the mining sector to the domestic industries. Now, if as expected, you see the handover to go very well while the terms of trade is deteriorating, it's quite likely that inflation would be rearing its ugly head, while growth may not necessarily be accelerating at a great pace. In your mind, which would take a higher importance, controlling inflation or maintaining growth?
Well, I'm not sure that I'd agree that the scenario you paint will lead to serious problems with inflation. I mean, historically, if the terms of trade are declining, that's less income, and that's in itself, as a shock, it's contractionary for the economy, so you wouldn't expect inflation to rise. Exchange rate goes down, that helps offset the contractionary shock, and it could give you, you know, a one-time lift in the price level, but then we'd be looking at what expectations are doing, and I think expectations remain well anchored, and really that's the key thing. The key thing in dealing with all these shocks from a monetary policy point of view is if you can keep the expectations anchored, you've got a much better chance of riding both on the real economy and the price side through successfully. And I think our inflation target is credible. We've been running it for 20 plus years now. We've achieved it. We'll still be achieving it. I think it is highly credible, and expectations are well anchored. If that weren't so, then I'd be much more worried.
Mr. Stevens, short follow-up on the property prices. How concerned are you about the low level of interest rates potentially fueling part of a bubble, and how much do you take that into account when you set monetary policy? Thank you.
Well, as I said earlier, we pay a lot of attention to asset values. I think I would say that in trying to assess whether policy is having the effect that we would expect, what would you look at? Well, one of the things you look at is you'd look at credit growth, which has remained low so far. You'd look at what are the savers doing with their money? Are they behaving in a way that suggests they see a signal to lighten up on their holdings of very low-risk assets where the returns have gone quite low and take a bit more risk? That's part of how monetary policy works. That's what's supposed to happen, and it is happening. And the housing prices are part of that dimension, as indeed are demand for equities. So we pay attention to that, and in calibrating, have we got the setting of the cash rate correct? That's one of the things we're looking at. Are the things occurring through the spectrum of financial and real assets that should be occurring if we've got an easy setting? I think the answer to that is yes, and that's why we've been sitting still. So we pay a good deal of attention to that. The possibility of a bubble is always something that one worries about. That's why we give warnings about, don't just assume prices always rise. It's okay for them to rise, but don't forget they can fall as well. So watch the leverage. That's really the main thing there. And we're trying to, I guess, keep the financial stability side of our mandate in view, as well as the price stability, full employment side.